Last week we really delved into the Hanukkah story and spoke a lot about sort of the non-Hebrew school version of the story. You know, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat, which is the kind of version we have of a lot of Jewish holidays. It's not really what happened. We focused a lot last week on how Hellenism, which was the rage philosophically in the world, was spreading throughout the ancient Near East, and Alexander the Great, who was the head of the Greek Empire in the very beginning. The Hanukkah story took place about 150 years after his death, after his kingdom was divided amongst three of his great generals, and the Seleucid Syrian Empire was governing over ancient Judea, and they were very emphatic about not simply living under Greek rule politically, but being Greek philosophically. And when I talk about being Greek philosophically, I'm not talking about Aristotle or Socrates or Plato, the great Greek philosophers. I'm talking about Hellenism, which was really a form of paganism that stressed the physical human bodies, Hercules and Zeus and all of the great Greek gods that they used to worship, and how a lot of this happened because the Jews themselves were beginning to assimilate and become Hellenized. We talked about this at length last week. And the irony of Hanukkah becoming popularized, why is Hanukkah so much more popular than, let's say, Purim in America? Because of its proximity to Christmas. And what's so interesting is that it's a holiday that's celebrating not the physical survival of the Jewish people, but really the spiritual survival of the Jewish people, because Jews were not being threatened physically. What was being threatened by the Hellenists and the Greeks and the Jews who became Hellenists, what was actually being threatened? Not Jewish physical survival, but our spiritual survival, right? The Greeks were not interested in killing Jews. What they wanted was to squash Judaism and replace it with Hellenism. And there were a lot of willing partners within the Jewish community that were trying to do that, were willing to do that. But there was a group that refused to allow Judaism to become completely assimilated into Hellenism, and that was the Maccabees. And the first thing they did upon prevailing in all of the wars, and there were a lot of wars, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. The wars were really fought to preserve Judaism, not physically Jews. Because, again, had the Jewish people just said, okay, it's enough of this Torah stuff, we'll give up our mitzvos and we'll become Hellenists, that would have been the end of the day. There wouldn't have been a battle. There wouldn't have been a war. And that's why, how do we celebrate Hanukkah?
We're going to need candles.
Didn't we have like a whole bunch? No? Okay, but you can take a menorah. You'll need to get your own candles. How do we celebrate this holiday? How? How do we celebrate Purim, which celebrates physical survival of the Jewish people? What do you do on Purim? You read the Megillah, good. That's kind of a spiritual way of celebrating, so that doesn't make my point. Keep going. You drink. You dress up, good. What else? You're supposed to give food to other people. Okay, and you're supposed to eat a meal, an actual feast. Okay, you're celebrating physically because you're celebrating the physical survival of the Jewish people. Haman didn't care whether you were a religious Jew or not. He was a little more similar. You know, there's a lot of talk about anti-Semitism, of unfortunately everything that happened last week in Jersey City, and those individuals, like Hitler, were not really concerned whether or not the people they were killing were religious Jews, Hasidic Jews, Reformed Jews. Doesn't matter. They just wanted dead Jews. Antiochus in the Hanukkah story was very different. He was trying to destroy Judaism, which is why we celebrate spiritually. Because what was at stake was our spiritual survival. We light a candle. We light the menorah. We say certain prayers, the challah. Whereas on Purim, when we're celebrating our physical survival, we celebrate by dressing up and by having a feast and getting drunk. And it's a very sort of physically hardy day because that's what we're celebrating.
As opposed to Hanukkah, we're really celebrating the spiritual survival of the Jewish people.
Any questions or comments on that? That's just sort of a little review of our discussion from last week. I know some of you weren't there, but I'm just going to... I don't want to have to repeat for those of you who were here. But any questions about that?
What major texts does it come from since it happened after
the Tanakh? So it's a good question. The major text that... the Talmud speaks about Hanukkah, but very, very quickly, and does not... spill much ink over Hanukkah. Most of the information we have about the Hanukkah holiday comes from Josephus, who was a great Jewish historian, and also two books that never made it into the Bible, Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2, that detail a lot of the Greek offenses against the Jews that were rebelling against the Greek Empire. So those are the sources for a lot of the information. One of the things we discussed last week was why don't Jewish sources dwell too much on the battle? There's almost no information in the Talmud about all the battles that ensued between the Jews and the Greeks. Why? Does anybody remember what we said last week? Who was here last week?
Mostly me.
Should I be repeating everything I said last week? I really feel badly now. All right, I'll be doing it again on Wednesday if you come back Wednesday. But... what I said basically was, I mean, why would you think? Let's dwell on that for a minute. I mean, there are not a lot of episodes in Jewish history where we really kicked butt, where the Jews were victorious. You know, we get kicked around a lot, particularly in the last 2,000 years in the diaspora. Why wouldn't Jewish sources detail all of our great victories against the Greeks? We're not a conquest, even if we get accused of being colonizers, right? That's not really who we are.
Is that why?
I don't know. It's a theory. Any other theories? What does the Talmud speak about? And what did you guys learn? I'm just when you went to Hebrew school or whatever Jewish education you have, what did you learn about Hanukkah? What does almost every Jew know about the holiday? The miracle of the oil, very good. And you know why every Jew knows about that miracle? Or more Jews know about that? Why the miracle of the oil? Because that's what the Talmud mentions. It says that after they were successful, after the Maccabees were successful against the Greeks, the first thing they did was they went into the temple. What happened? What did the Greeks do to our temple? They didn't just physically destroy it. They made it into a place of idol worship, where Jews were forced to bring sacrifices to Greek gods. So what was the first thing they did when they marched into the temple? They had to clean it up a little. They had to perform one mitzvah that was always done daily in the temple, lighting the menorah, and they only could find one cruse of oil that was pure. And they lit it, and somehow, miraculously, it lasted for 8 days, long enough for the Jews to obtain fresh supplies. And that's what everybody knows. But I could keep you here, and I did last week. I could keep you all here, detailing all of the miracles on the battlefield. So how come the miracles on the battlefield are not mentioned in the Talmud? Only the miracle of the oil. So Jason is suggesting, because we don't want to come across as a glorifying war kind of people. Okay, that's a good theory. Any other theories? Yeah?
Looks much better to display a menorah than a sword in your window.
Yeah, okay, how would you celebrate? Every Jew find one Greek and kill him. Just kidding. It's not the same people, so that would just be wrong.
It's by celebrating the oil, it's like you're celebrating miracle.
Good. Some people say that as miraculous as these battles were, there's some people who could say, well, you never know. It's not really a revealed miracle. Like, would you call 1967, the Six-Day War, a miracle? Has anyone even studied about what happened in 1967? Now, I would call it a miracle. But I'm a rabbi, so that's what we do. We call everything miracles. No. But a lot of people could be a little cynical. I'm sure if we had a nice cynical Israeli here. Do we have any cynical Israelis? No, but a cynical Israeli would say, ah, the IDF has the best intelligence in the world. I just watched The Spy. Does anybody see the show The Spy with Sacha Baron Cohen?
Yeah.
And what was the... He was playing Eli Cohen, who was a great spy for Israel. And by the way, because of Eli Cohen's unbelievable infiltration of the Syrian government, the Six-Day War was... I mean, it helped a lot, being successful. We knew where everything was. So someone could say, oh, there weren't any real miracles, the Six-Day War. It was Eli Cohen, great spy. So that's what some people say. You can't deny that a cruise of oil, which was one day, lasted for eight, that's a miracle. That just flies in the face of science. So nobody could deny that it was a miracle. That's God. But the war, okay, the Maccabees were really smart and really tough dudes. And they split the camp up into different parts. Then they were able to guerrilla warfare and they kicked some Greek butt. And that's what some people say. But what I shared last week, which it was brilliant. I mean, you had to be here. It was really unbelievable. Last week what I shared was, what would it be like if you and I knew all the stories about the Maccabean defeat of the Greek forces and details, and you studied that in Hebrew school, and Hanukkah came to mean the Maccabean defeat of the Greek forces, what would you think this holiday was all about? Again, you would think, again, they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. We would again think that this is another attempt to simply destroy Jews. What's that?
Yeah, that it was like physically.
Physical, good.
Purim?
That's exactly what Purim is. That's what Purim is, but that's not Hanukkah. We wouldn't need another holiday then. The rabbis don't give us holiday after holiday that are celebrating the same thing. This is celebrating something very distinct and different. And it causes us, therefore, to think about Hanukkah very differently. What do you really think about on Hanukkah when you light the menorah now? That anyone who tries to kill us, we can fight back? No, that's not what they were doing. They weren't trying to kill us. They were trying to kill Judaism. When we allow ourselves, and it wasn't just them, and I spent a lot of time last week. I've said that many times. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm just don't want to sound repetitive. But this was a lot of Jewish people themselves who wanted to appear more Greek than Jewish. One of the things I said was, and Josephus Flavius wrote this in his history book, that the Jewish people actually built a gymnasium near the temple. Now, it wasn't like Equinox, where you just go and work out. When I say a Greek gymnasium was, they actually started the games by sacrificing to the Greek gods. They played the games in the nude because they celebrated the body, the physical body. You ever see like those Greek statues of Zeus and Hercules? Like, and that's why they banned circumcision, because it was like blasphemous for the Greeks. And there were Jewish kids that were being lured away from the temple service, young priests, young Kohanim, being pulled away from the temple, and they were covering up their circumcisions, Josephus writes, so they could seem and look more Greek than Jewish. That's what was happening in the Jewish community. And so when the Maccabees rose up against the Greeks, it wasn't because they were trying to kill us. It was because they thought that Torah, mitzvot, spiritual Jewish life was going to be destroyed. And the only way to keep it alive was to get the Greeks out. So the battle was almost incidental. The battle, what was really being fought over, was Judaism. You understand? So that's why I think, this is my theory, and I've seen this written by others, that's why I think the rabbis left out all the battles from the Talmud, because we would get obsessed with them. Because let's face it, we've been the victims for many centuries. So once in a while, when we become like, you know, strong and we're successful on the battlefield, we're probably going to go crazy with it. And then we're going to misunderstand what this holiday is about, which is a celebration of Jewish spiritual survival. And by the way, that is so relevant today.
Just to clarify, you said the Jews built a gymnasium next to the temple. You meant the Greeks built the gymnasium, right?
Jews and Greeks together. Jewish Hellenists with their Greek counterpart.
So not like not people who wanted to support Judaism or learn.
No, what I mentioned last week was that there was the brother of the high priest, the authentic high priest. His name was Chanyo. He had a brother who Hellenized his name to Jason. He raised a lot of money to bribe Antiochus. I know. Bunch of Hellenists right here with us tonight. He raised money to bribe Antiochus to build a gymnasium for the Jews, because they wanted to see more. Now, why is that relevant today? Why is this such an important conversation? Now, unfortunately, given what happened last week and what's happening a lot in America today, physical anti-Semitism is just trying to kill Jews, not Judaism. We could probably apply the Purim story, which was celebrating physical survival, to what's happening also today. But I think what happens around Christmas time is kind of interesting in the Jewish community. Because why is Hanukkah so much more popular than Purim? They're both post-biblical holidays. They both have the same exact status, and yet, whenever I'm not going to ask for show of hands, but whenever I ask a group of young Jewish professionals, did you grow up with Purim in your home or Hanukkah in your home? Everybody had Hanukkah. Some people had Purim. How did Hanukkah get more popular?
Presents.
Presents. Christmas. If it wasn't for Christmas, Hanukkah would be as observed as Purim, probably. And if you think about it, Purim is like, it's like Mardi Gras. It's like Halloween for Jews. It's so much fun. You know? Hanukkah became very popular, and another amazing thing we did last week, such nostalgia from last week, is I read an article with all of you about, written by Herman Woke, about, no, it's fine, I could have just used, I did all this research with new stuff, but like, whatever. Because the other stuff I did last week is really fundamental. So Herman Woke, anybody hear of Herman Woke? He wrote an amazing book, you must get. I don't get a commission. And he's no longer alive, so I don't know if he's getting a commission anymore. He just died a few months ago. He was 102. He lived in Washington. And he lived on the Upper West Side in the 1940s. And in the 1950s, he wrote this book. And he has a little section on Hanukkah. And he tells what was going on in America in the 1950s. Why Jews started celebrating a little Christmas. Anybody know?
They're around the same time.
More of a reason.
Fear of missing out.
What's that?
Fear of missing out.
It's FOMO. Yeah. There was always FOMO. They just had a cool name for it today. There was always FOMO. Jewish parents felt guilty because there were very few Jewish schools, so most Jewish kids went to public schools. You go to public school, there wasn't as many Jews either. And all your friends are having an awesome time, you know, drinking their eggnog, sitting around the tree, exchanging presents. The whole city is alit with Christmas. And there was more anti-Semitism back then in the 1950s, and Jews didn't walk around so easily. My dad, he shouldn't be well, to this day cringes sometimes when I walk with a kippah. Because it's not something he grew up being used to doing. And he grew up as a religious Jew. And even in New York, there were a lot of incidents of anti-Semitism. And you didn't want your kids feeling left out and feeling crappy, excuse me, about their Judaism. So you want to give them a little something. So, oh, we got Hanukkah, let's do that. And we borrowed the gift idea from the Christians. And we try to kind of compete a little. They have their Christmas, we have their Hanukkah. And that's how Hanukkah got famous with Jews. Think about the irony of that for a moment. What is Hanukkah celebrating? Now you're all experts because I've repeated it 10 times. Hanukkah celebrating the ability of a Jewish minority living in a different majority culture to maintain their own Jewish traditions. And the reason we have popularized Hanukkah is because we want to keep up with our Christian neighbors. So it's a little interesting, it's a little ironic, but as Herman Woke said, I'll take it. I don't really care why a Jewish holiday gets popular. It can only be good. Right? There's nothing wrong with that, and there's nothing wrong with giving some gifts. It used to be Hanukkah gelt, now it's gifts. Nishkefeach, there are worse things, you know? But it's important to remember and to think about our Jewish identity at this time of year. And he ends his article, I wish I had it before me, because he said, we have to remember one thing. Because if it wasn't for the Maccabees defeating the Greeks, not only would there not be a Hanukkah today, there also wouldn't be any Christmas. Because Judaism would have been squelched. It would have been squashed. And Jesus would never have been born. There would never have been another monotheistic faith that was born out of Judaism, which was Christianity. And there's a lot hanging on this, therefore. And our ability to maintain ourselves when other people are living a different life. And here, we can make a distinction between America. Because what does America believe? What are the ideals of this great country in which we live? That you have to conform? You have to be American before Jewish? You have to be Greek? No. What is actually America? What is the United States? What does our Constitution actually guarantee for us? Freedom of religion. That you can choose to be whoever you want. There is no church. I mean, I was going to say there is no Church of England. How did the United States come to be? Yeah, but they were fighting against the Church of England. That's how the colonists broke free and became independent. They wanted to separate, right, the state, the religion, and the state. And that's why we have tremendous opportunities in the United States to live freely as Jews. But we somehow still feel, I don't know, maybe it's FOMO. Maybe we all have a little FOMO. We see everybody else living in a certain way and we think we need to live that way too. And you know what? Not only is that an injustice to being Jewish, it actually flies in the face of the very purpose for the creation of this republic, of the United States of America. The very purpose for the existence of this country was to enable people to choose their own religion. And somehow we feel insecure. And we want to be popular, and we want to be accepted. So we think to be popular and to be accepted, we need to copy other people. And that way we'll be more loved. One of the things that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks always likes to say is that non-Jews are sometimes a little embarrassed of Jews that are embarrassed of their own religion, and often respect Jews who respect their own religion, even if, you know, that doesn't mean you have to wear it on your sleeve. But, you know, they say that on a college campus you will find many great African-American scholars, teachers are standing up for African-American rights, and you'll find gay professors on college campus standing up for gay rights, and you'll find Latin American professors on college campus standing up for Latin American rights, and then you'll find a Jewish professor on college campus standing up for African American, gay, and Latino rights. That's the classic, you know. But somehow we're a little embarrassed of our own faith. And Hanukkah is really a celebration, again, not to wear it on a sleeve or to think somehow we're better than everyone else, but to just be proud of who we are. And to celebrate who we are, and to remember that just because everyone else is living something else, back then it was Hellenism, today it's I don't know what, doesn't mean we can't still be committed to our Judaism, even as we are loyal citizens in this great country. Okay, my little tirade is over. I have something else I want to share with you. Any comments or questions? Now that I reviewed most of last week's class. They really do smell good. They do. You know what else is really nice? I mean, I said this. How nice is it when you walk outside and all the lights they put in my building? I live on this block. It's a very easy commute for me. On my building, they put like these beautiful like little lights on the awning. It's just so pretty. You go to Midtown, sides of traffic. It's really like a very pretty time, and people are a little nicer. So it's actually a great time of year. It is. An ice skating rink, and yeah, the tree smells nice. So it's a good point. Any other comments? Yes?
So I have a comment regarding work.
Yes.
Business.
Business.
And I guess accepting all cultures and religions, but at the same time, knowing that you live in a Christian country and that Christmas... the the holiday Christmas is going to be very big. You know, like Secret Santa, Christmas holiday parties.
Right.
It's a very big thing in America.
Right.
In secular world.
Mm-hmm.
Modern day.
So, I mean, I think, I don't know what, I don't know where you work exactly.
I work for engineering consultants.
Right, so I don't know if there, is it really a Christmas party? Is it more like a New Year's, they call them holiday parties?
They call it holiday party, but it's definitely Christmas.
Because most of the people there are observing Christmas over Judaism. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with going to the party as long as it, as if, I don't know if that's what you're asking, you know, as long as it's not, you know, celebrating Christmas per se. I think especially in New York City, it's a little more, even if there's a tree there, it's more like they're celebrating the holiday. The holiday's become incredibly commercialized in our day and age. You know, when I moved into my building here on this block, they thought I would be offended because they wanted to have a tree. You know, that I'm a rabbi, I'm an Orthodox rabbi, you can't have a tree in the building with the Orthodox, you know, crazy rabbi that's here. And I said, why? Just, you know, make sure you get a menorah, because we've got some Jews in the building too. So, have the Christmas tree for the Christians, and let's have a menorah for the Jews, and everybody's happy. And then they put a wreath. I don't know why. They didn't want to offend anyone. Christmas tree was like too Christian, and the menorah was like too, so they have like a wreath. Looks like somebody died. What's that?
It says pagan, though, anyhow, the tree, really.
I know. History, I know. I know. Yeah. It is, yeah. But, I wouldn't make too big of a deal of it. If you're asking me if they're actually doing some sort of Christmas prayers.
No, it wasn't praying. It was just a matter of partaking in the game with Secret Santa.
Oh. What's that? Well, I mean, if it is a Santa, I think people would understand that a Jew doesn't want to, you know, play Secret Santa. I mean,
Jews do it too. They just call it something else.
Right.
Yeah, Mr. Gaffney.
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole new. There's unfortunately a market for this.
Yeah.
It's called Chrismica gifts. Because we have so many interfaith marriages where one person is Christian, the other person is Jewish, so they have Chrismica gifts now. I'm not a fan, that's all I will say. But that's our state in this country right now. Any other comments or questions? Just about any questions about the Hanukkah miracle and all that? Does anyone know how we actually celebrate the holiday? Just
here. Sorry, I don't have candles to illustrate with. By the way, Yudi was giving out.
Yeah, we're getting them.
Oh, we are?
Yeah.
So, if you have a menorah, and if you don't have one, just grab one. Every night of the holiday, we light another night representing that night of the holiday. And we make, how many blessings? We make two blessings each night except the first night. The first night, there's an additional blessing, which is called the Shechiyanu. So first you make the blessing of Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, to kindle the flame of Chanukah. The second, Sha'asa Nisim, God who performed miracles, La'avotenu, for our forefathers, Bizman Bayamim Ahem, back then, Bizman Hazeh, to this day. And then finally, the Shechiyanu on the first night. Make sure to try to put your menorah where? The windowsill. Now, let's say your windowsill has a beautiful view, as one of mine does in my apartment, of the adjoining building's brick wall. And the only one who can see your menorah is the occasional pigeon that likes to, hang out on your windowsill. So what you could do with your menorah then is, and I'm sure you've never heard of this, this might freak you out a little more, you could open up your front door of your apartment, put it opposite the mezuzah in your home. And that way it could be, because you're supposed to publicize the miracle, it's supposed to be public. That's just one tradition. That way when you come in and out, you're surrounded by mitzvot, the mezuzah on one side, the menorah on the other, and that way the people in the hallway can sort of partake of it, because you're supposed to sort of let the world know about the holiday of Hanukkah. Now, if that's going to freak your neighbors out or get you thrown out of the building,
or start a fire.
You shouldn't start a fire wherever you put your menorah. Then you can just put it in the most congregated area of your home where more people, where there's a little more traffic. But this is very different than Shabbos candles. When you light Shabbat candles, What is the purpose of lighting the Shabbat candles as opposed to the menorah? Shabbat candles are for what? Good. It's actually supposed to try to create illumination for your home. Now, I know what you're all thinking. This is what creates illumination in our homes. Not a little fakakta candle. That creates ambiance. But it's technically supposed to create light, which is why, and this is not a discussion for now, I always suggest people before they light their Shabbat candles, they should always turn off a light, an incandescent bulb, a real electric light. Turn it on for the sake of Shabbat, and then you light your Shabbat candles, and keep in mind both the electric light and the candle that you just lit. Because the mitzvah of Hadlakat Neirot for Shabbat is really to create illumination and to enjoy the light. That's why if you light over there in the corner and you're sitting over here, you're not really fulfilling the mitzvah. You're supposed to actually benefit from the light, not your menorah. Your menorah, you're not creating to illuminate your home. You're creating it as a symbol of the miracle that you're trying to project to the world. Which is why I try to put it in the windowsill if there's some people who can pass by and see it. All right, very, very different purposes in these mitzvot. There's the Friday night when you do both. Which one do you do first? Shabbat candles or menorah? Friday night?
Menorah.
Correct, because?
Can't light
Excellent. All right. Very good. And then what about on Saturday night? First you do Havdalah. Take out Shabbat with Havdalah, and then you light the menorah on Saturday night. Okay? The candles should last at least 30 minutes into nightfall. The best time to light them is when it starts getting dark, although probably most of you are still at work. So as soon as you get home, light the menorah. It's a mitzvah that can be done all night, so if you can't get home first to light them, and you got to go out and meet somebody, you could light them at night. You're technically only supposed to light them when there are people in the street, but hey, we live in Manhattan, so if you live in the city or in some place where there are just people, you could really light it all night.
Always people in that parking lot.
That's great. Right.
They have their sirens at
4
in the morning.
Oh, I can keep. That's great. That's beautiful. So that's really the purpose of the menorah, the Hanukkah candles. I want to show you a picture. Take a look on your handout. Take a look at this menorah. It's kind of an interesting picture. Can anybody see what I'm seeing?
Swastika.
You see the swastika in the background? Really interesting. This picture is a menorah on a windowsill on the eighth night. You see all the candles are there? They're eight night. They're eight candles. In Kiel, Germany in 1931. Kiel had a Jewish population of 500. And it was the last night of Hanukkah. It was a Friday night. And the rabbi of the town, the spiritual leader, his name is Rabbi Posner, was rushing to light the menorah before Shabbos. And his home was directly across from Peel's Nazi headquarters, where the flag with the swastika could be seen in the background. And on the back of the picture, his wife, Rachel, wrote the words, Hanukkah 5692. And it's now 5780. It was Hanukkah 5692, Judea dies. And thus says the banner, Judea will live forever. Thus responds the lights. This is what she wrote. Hanukkah 5692. Judea dies, thus says the banner. Judea will live forever, thus responds the lights. Meaning like the menorah was kind of standing there in response to the swastika. Which I thought was a very, very sort of powerful image. But I mentioned just a moment ago that the most important aspect of the mitzvah of lighting the candles is persume nis. If you can come out of two words, two Hebrew words out of our class tonight, persum, lefarsem, means to publicize, nes is a miracle. Lefarsem et hanes, persume nisa, which means publicizing the miracle. Now turn the page, please. I want to read something with you from Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher and Talmudist. The precept of lighting the Hanukkah. Let's get to... Would you like to read?
Sure. No, I'll write it out.
Top paragraph.
The precept of lighting the Hanukkah lamp is exceedingly precious, and one should carefully observe it in order to proclaim the miracle, ever praising and thanking God for the miracles which he has performed for us. Even if one has nothing to eat except what he gets from charity, he should borrow or sell his garment to buy oil lamps and light them.
And so what's going on here? The Rambam calls the menorah a very exceedingly precious mitzvah. And he says, does anybody know other mitzvot that have this idea of presuming nisa? Do we do anything else in Judaism to publicize a miracle? Is Hanukkah the only time on the Jewish calendar we do this? What other events or what other rituals?
Shofar.
Shofar is interesting. It's more of like a call. It's more of a wake-up call. I mean, it has a little of that effect. That's a good suggestion. What other mitzvah do we do? Presume a mitzvah? Yeah?
Either when we open the door on Pesach, or...
We open the door on Passover to... why do we open the door on Passover?
For
Elijah to come in? No? Yeah. Someone once asked the question, if Elijah can manage to stay alive all these years... I'm sure he could figure out a way in without you and I having to open the door. It's more of a symbolic way of saying that we're anticipating the next redemption. Because the Seder represents the old redemption from Egypt, which is supposed to be an allusion for the future redemption, the days of the Messiah. What other rituals can you think of? These are good suggestions.
Sukkah
represents something completely different. Going out of your secure home. What's that? It's public. They're all public things. But to publicize a miracle. We're not really making the sukkah to publicize a miracle. We're trying to show that what really protects us is God, not our physical homes. Michal, what were you going to say?
Well, I don't know if this is like a... Isn't Pesach celebrating the splitting of the sea?
Yeah, so what do we actually drink on Passover to remember all of those miracles?
Wine.
What do we drink? We drink how many cups? We do 4 cups of wine. And the 4 cups of wine are supposed to be expressing the concept of presume nisa. Because why 4 cups? Because there are 4 expressions of redemption that are mentioned in the Bible. So we drink 4 different cups, and each time we drink a cup, it's a way of publicly symbolizing God's redemption of the Jewish people. Also, Purim. What do we do to publicly celebrate and put out there the miracle of Purim? You mentioned it earlier. We read the Megillah. We publicly read the Megillah, which is the story of the miracle of Purim. Now, the Rambam, Maimonides, we just read from, does not call those mitzvot. What did he call this? Exceedingly precious. What is so special about Hanukkah? Not only that, look what else it says. Even if his one has nothing to eat except what he gets from charity... This is a very poor person, a person who's completely reliant on handouts. Even such a person, says Maimonides, has to borrow or even sell his clothing to get oil and lamps and light them. By the way, doesn't say that about Shabbos candles. Very important to light Shabbat candles, but if you don't have enough money, then you don't do it. But this you have to. What is it about Hanukkah candles that is so significant? What does it also celebrate? So we talked about before, what is it celebrating? The spiritual survival of the Jewish people. We dwelt on that for a while, for the second week in a row. It also celebrates, though, something else. And that is a certain relationship that we have, we believe, with God. Which was ratified in this thing called the covenant. We have a covenant of the Jewish people with God. And the Hellenists were trying to demonstrate that, yeah, we know that you had that covenant. But it was only useful to combat inferior or pagan nations. But now we have Hellenism. We have a more refined approach to life. The Hellenists, many Jews among them, were arguing that Torah had a place in history for your ancestors. But no longer today. Before Greece came into existence, the Greeks understood there was a need for Torah to keep the Jewish people civilized amongst the pagan cults who inhabited the land of Israel. But now, we've given you Greek culture. We've given you Greek philosophy. Why do you need this Torah anymore? You don't need to keep up this covenant with God, which is all about you, Jews, keeping your Torah. Once the Jewish people would have the general wisdom that the Greeks would bring to the world, the covenant was no longer necessary. And it was really within that context that Matityahu and the Maccabees arose in revolt. They weren't simply fighting the Greeks. They were fighting to ensure that the Jewish people would continue to see themselves as party to a deal that was brokered by our ancestors Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with God Himself. And that is what Maoz Tzur, the special song that we sing after we light the menorah, comes to symbolize. Take a look at the Maoz Tzur. You guys sing the song after you light the menorah. Two, three, okay. Maoz Tzur. You know what it's about? The English is actually really interesting. It's like a little survey of Jewish history. Every paragraph is another superpower that tried to take out the Jews, and somehow we survived. The first paragraph speaks of, let's read it in the English, refuge, rock of my salvation. To you it is a delight to give praise. He's talking about God. Restore my house of prayer. Right? What happened? The Greeks took the temple and converted it into a house of idol worship. When you silence the loud-mouthed foe, then I will complete with song and psalm the altar's dedication. What does Chanukah actually mean? The word Chanukah? Anybody know? Chanukah? Anybody ever move into a new apartment and you throw a little party to celebrate your move-in and you call it a Chanukat Habayit? Chanukah means dedication. Because when the Maccabees came in, they rededicated the temple. That's what Chanukah actually means. So we're thanking God that He gave us back the temple. But the next four paragraphs go through the ups and downs of Jewish history. The first paragraph, take a look, starts with Egypt.
Troubles sated my soul, my strength was spent with sorrow, they embittered my life with hardship when I was enslaved under Egyptian rule. But God with His great power brought out His treasured people, while Pharaoh's host and followers sank like a stone into the deep. Right? Nechama mentioned the splitting of the Red Sea. And then the next paragraph, Babylon. Because who toppled the Egyptian Empire? It was actually the Assyrians, but then came the Babylonians. They were the ones to destroy our first temple. He brought me into His holy abode. But even there I found no rest. The oppressor came and exiled me, because I had served strange gods. That was the main sin for which the first temple was destroyed, idol worship. I had drunk poison wine, I almost perished. Then Babylon fell, Zerubbabel came. Within 70 years I was saved. How long were the Jews exiled after the destruction of the first temple? 70 years. Most of the thousands of Jews were killed, but then the survivors fled to Babylon, modern-day Iraq. But then we came back to Israel. Because who toppled the Babylonian Empire? Think of Purim. That's the Purim story. The Persian Empire. And after the Purim story, the Jews came back to Israel. At least some of them did. Under the more tolerant Persian emperor, Darius. Who some people believe was the product of Esther and Ahasuerus. It's a theory. And we came back. And it says the Agagat, the son of help me out. Who is Agagi ben Hamdata? That's referring to Haman, the Purim story. Now it's telling about the Persian conquest of the Jewish people. Sought to cut down the tall, firm tree, but it became a trap to him, and his arrogance was brought to an end. You raised the head of the Benjamite. Who's the Benjamite? Benjaminite. That was Mordechai. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. And the enemy's name you blotted out. His many sons and his household you hanged on the gallows. Who was hung on the gallows in the end? That was Haman and his sons. And then the Greeks came, because who toppled the Persian Empire? The Greeks. And the Greeks gathered against me in the days of the Hashmonaim, those are the Maccabees. They broke down the walls of my towers and defiled all the oils. But from that last remaining flask, a miracle was wrought for your beloved. Therefore the sages ordained these 8 days for song and praise.
So at least these four paragraphs of the Maoz Tzur are basically the ups and downs of Jewish history. And the message is very clear, that no matter where we are or who ruled over us, no matter what culture we happen to live within, the covenant between God and the Jewish people always remains. And now we can answer the original question. Why is Hanukkah so special? Why is it that if a person is so poor, they have to even sell the shirt off their back to light the menorah? Why does the Rambam call it just a exceedingly precious day, distinguishing it from the four cups that we drink on Passover or the reading of the Megillah on Purim, which are also expressions of publicizing the miracle, because only the candles of Hanukkah symbolize the eternity of the covenant and the special relationship that God has with the Jewish people. It's a very, very important and beautiful idea I wanted to share with you. And the candles don't only attest to the miracle of Hanukkah, they also attest that God is still with us wherever we are, even if we don't live in Israel, and even if it doesn't seem we live in very prophetic or holy times, we still believe that Hashem is with us. And so even as we are exposed to other cultures and other wisdoms, and by the way, don't walk out of this class thinking, oh, the rabbi thinks all other wisdoms and all other cultures are bad. No, they're only bad when they try to take us out. We can actually learn. I've studied a lot of Greek philosophy. The great Maimonides that we just quoted from, he called Aristotle his master and his teacher. But Aristotle was not an anti-Semite trying to stomp out Judaism. Neither was Plato or Socrates. It was the Hellenists and Antiochus. But we can learn from other faiths and cultures and wisdom. And that's why, I mean, MGE in particular is an institution that believes in a approach of Torah with the best of Western civilization. I try to incorporate as much as I can, not only Torah wisdom in my classes, but secular wisdom sometimes as well. There's nothing wrong with that. But those wisdoms should never be thought of as replacing Torah. Because only Torah can really keep us connected to God, because Torah is a much more of a direct expression of God's wisdom. You can study psychology, you can study literature, you can study philosophy. And I do believe through the study of these disciplines, you can get closer to God. But the Torah can enable you to be closer, because it's a more direct path to Hashem, because it was given to us from God Himself. And whether it's Hellenism in the days of Greece, or it's some new ideology in America today, whatever it is, Judaism, by virtue of it being a divine kind of wisdom, is always going to be relevant, and it's always going to fill our lives with light. The kind of light that we were supposed to not only enjoy ourselves, but share with the rest of humanity. That's why we put these menorahs on our windowsill. Because it's not just to tell everyone, you tried to kill me, look, I'm still here. No, this is the light of our Judaism that we're supposed to share with the world. And that's hard sometimes when you're being chased and someone's calling you a nasty name. But not everybody's chasing us and not everybody hates us. And we shouldn't be allowed to think that although anti-Semitism is unfortunately on the rise, that doesn't mean everybody hates the Jew. And it doesn't mean that people don't want to learn from us. Because people who know their history know that whatever community Jews have lived in, we've always contributed to the society in which we've lived. We've always given so much to the rest of the world. And that is one of our purposes and our jobs, is to be a light amongst the nations. So let's keep in mind what we're publicizing. It's not just the victory against the Greeks, but it's the eternity of our covenant, and it's the relevance of Torah, our special relationship, which we can share a little. Not to gloat and say, look who I am, but look what I have that you can also partake of, to have some wisdom and enlightenment in your life. And that's really, I think, one of the great powerful messages of Hanukkah. Okay, I squeezed in tonight's class there. Yes, Jason, number two. Oh, very good. Before the holiday of Hanukkah, what was the menorah? Where was the menorah? Where did we get this menorah from, actually? The temple, good. It was actually in the tabernacle, even before there was a permanent temple in Jerusalem. When God told the Jews in the wilderness V'asuli mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, v'shachanti b'tocham, and I will dwell there. He commanded Moses to create a menorah. And it's very specific in the Bible, in the Torah, it had to be miksha zahav, one block of gold. It was one of the only vessels, I think the only vessel in the temple, that couldn't be made up of different pieces. You literally started with a huge block of gold, and they would chip away and create this beautiful menorah. Our Chanukiyahs are a little different. We have 8 branches. I think the menorah in the temple was 6 or 7. I think 7. I think you're right. So it was a little different, but it really represents the light of Judaism. And it was supposed to be lit daily. Whose job in the days of the Bible was it to light the menorah every day? Who got that gig in the wilderness? Not Moses, but his brother Aaron. Because he was a Kohen, and that became the job of the Kohanim to light the menorah. What's that? No, Moshe, they were both from the tribe of Levi, their brothers. The tribe of Levi is split up into 2 groups, Kohanim and Leviim. It's a little deceiving because Leviim sounds like a whole group. And any direct descendants of Aaron became Kohanim to this day. And by the way, there's a Jewish gene for Kohanim. What's the name of the university? Hopkins actually did the study. Not every Kohen is a Kohen, by the way. A lot of cats is a Kohanim. But the Kohanim were always the ones who lit the menorah. By the way, the Maccabees, the Maccabean family, the Hashmonaim, who fought against the Greeks, they were all Kohanim. So it was very appropriate for them, actually, when they came into the temple, to light that menorah. So that was always the job of the Kohen. Anybody know why? Why is that a perfect job for a Kohen? Because the job of a Kohen was to be the teacher. The Kohanim were that group in the Jewish community that was supposed to be teaching the rest of the Jews about Judaism. So the light of the menorah, which is representing Torah, was a very appropriate thing for the Kohanim, who were the teachers, to light. And that's very appropriate for this discussion, because what does the Torah call the Jewish people? The Torah in the book of Exodus actually refers to the Jewish people as Mamlechet Kohanim, kingdom of Kohanim. Why are we a kingdom of priests for the world? Because what's the job of a Kohen within the Jewish community? There's this one special small group within the Jews. Their task is to teach the rest of the Jewish people what it means to be Jewish. The light of Torah. And amongst the nations of the world, there's this one group of people called the Jewish people that are all Kohanim, if you will, to teach the rest of the humanity about ethical monotheism. It's also all very connected. So that's the lighting of the menorah. Yes?
But couldn't you say that Moshe was the first teacher, because he brought down the tablets?
Yes.
And was trying to educate?
He was 100% historically. It would be inaccurate to say anything else. He was God's first pupil when it came to Torah. You could say Abraham, but he was the one that God gave the Torah through. And Moshe then taught that Torah to the rest of the Jewish people. So he was the ultimate teacher.
Yeah,
but the priestly caste was given to Aaron, his brother, and his direct descendants. Yeah.
Excellent. That's a good point. Any other comments, questions? Any? Yes? So that is a quote from the Zohar.
Oh, definitely.
The Zohar is the writings of Kabbalah.
Yes.
And it says famously in the Zohar, he's stakel be'oraita. It's written in Aramaic. Stakel means to look, oraita, at the Torah. God looked at the Torah. Ubara alma, and created the world. The Kabbalists believe that the Torah predated human existence and the world as we know it. Because think about it. Before you build something, what do? Right, you need a blueprint. You hire an expensive architect, draws up the blueprint, and then you keep consulting the blueprint when you're creating whatever it is you want to create. But think about it. It's such a profound idea, because it allows us to look at the Torah very, very differently. It's not like God created people, didn't know what to do with us, and he gave us, you do this. No. The reason he created us and the whole world was to carry out the purpose of the Torah, which predated.
There's a real plan. We're part of a very well thought out plan.
It's quite specific, actually. Even if we don't always understand the whole thing. You know, it's a great point. Thank you.
Yeah, that was
it's a great line. It says a lot, that one line. Any other comments or questions? Okay, what are we giving each other for Hanukkah? Oh yeah, why do we eat latkes? Just oily. It's really good. I don't think there's anything more profound than that. And sufganiyot? Same thing, oil. Just really unhealthy. Enjoy it. But that's what we do. So you're all invited a week from tonight, correct?
Yes, a week from tonight we'll be having a Hanukkah Chagiga. So basically just loving the menorah, live music. We're going to have a dreidel tournament.
Ooh.
Fingers ready. And decorating more donuts. There'll be latkes. And it's going to be a really fun night. And it's going to be here instead of classes. We're going to be doing that.
Oh, there will be a class at 7.
Rabbi Avi Heller, if you would like more Hanukkah inspiration, there'll be a class that's.
I think 7. The menorah lighting is like right after that. So, like, it's a very quick.
No, we're doing a little later, actually. Yeah, I think he's doing. We'll send you out the information, but it's. I think the menorah lighting won't take place till 8, I think.
Okay.
But we'll make sure. My son and his amazing roommate and my amazing son are going to be playing also. They're pretty good. So if you want to...
The guy who's playing, he organized a concert in Times Square this year that has like 200 people at. So we're going to have him do that in a pre-Hanukkah happy hour at called Prompt.